Thank you, Clive. And now to our first session, which is the global economic shift. And our first speaker, Bob Yeager, who's a senior market strategist with BNY Mellon Asset Management. He's actually worked with BNY for 25 years or thereabouts. These days, he's senior market strategist for BNY Mellon Asset Management, working with large institutional clients on issues related to investment policy and asset allocation, and spends his time touring the world talking about these issues. Prior to that, for a long stretch, he was working as vice chairman and chief investment officer of EACM, which is a subsidiary of the company, which acts as a kind of manager of managers. For a long time, he'd been an academic at Yale University and then at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, not in the financial area, but in philosophy. And he taught logic, philosophy of science, theory of knowledge. So we're going to hear basically a wonderful amalgam of considerations of the global economic crisis and a touch of philosophy. I'll introduce our second speaker, Don Russell, after we hear from Bob. So please welcome Bob Yeager. I'll sort some water out for you, Bob.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Peter. It's a great pleasure to be here. Always enjoy coming to Sydney, and I always enjoy hanging out with actuaries, so it's good to be able to combine these two pleasures. The philosophy stuff emerged informally in a conversation with Peter before the session. I don't mind telling people about the PhD. I don't usually get into all the philosophy stuff, but thank you, Peter. It turns out that there are important connections between the philosophy business and the investment business. And as soon as I figure out what they are, I'll pass them on to you. So my mission for the morning, for the next 20 minutes to half an hour, is to talk a little bit about lessons to be learned from the financial meltdown. I would say the recent financial meltdown, but I think we might still be in it, despite the more positive tone of the last several weeks. Warren Buffett allegedly said, and he probably was not the only person to say this, that what we learn from experience is that we learn nothing from experience. So the risk in these situations is that you think there are tremendous lessons to be learned, and then 6 months later, you're back to business as usual, and the lessons are all conveniently forgotten. So the lessons that I hope to draw this morning might wind up in that category, more stuff in the great dustbin of history. So I'm counting on the higher-than-average intelligence of the actuarial community to keep some of these lessons alive a little bit longer, perhaps give them a slightly longer shelf life. The lessons that I have in mind fall into three main categories. First of all, some general lessons about markets. Secondly, some lessons about portfolio construction or portfolio architecture. And thirdly, some lessons about the major asset classes. So in terms of the nature of markets, I have a long-standing obsession with the efficient market view of the world. And I apologize for inflicting some of this on you, but I actually do think it relates to the, very importantly, to the recent crisis. We've been taught for many years that markets are efficient. It seems to me pretty clearly that if you want efficient markets, you need to go to finance textbooks. In the real world, what you mainly find are markets that are inefficient. And I think in the recent period, in some of these meltdown episodes, what you've seen are markets that are essentially deficient, or that are in some ways have become dysfunctional or broken. And in making this three-part distinction, there are three main dimensions that I have in mind listed here. In an ideal efficient market, you have three important features. First of all, investors are totally rational. Secondly, investors trade with one another to wind up assigning prices to securities that follow a random walk. So random walks have unpredictable outcomes, and also in a random walk, each event in a random walk is statistically independent of all the other events. And number three, random walks tend to lead to symmetrical or normal return distributions. So you wind up with the idea that the prices of ordinary stocks and bonds are going to wind up being symmetrically distributed. In an inefficient market, I think for the most part, investors are not terribly rational, or at least they're not rational in the way that conforms to the the beautifully simple models. Fear and greed obviously play an important role in normal markets. And on top of that, over the last many years, we have the growing field, the burgeoning field of behavioral finance, which has identified a tremendous number of what they tend to call biases and heuristics that people rely on in their ordinary decision-making behavior. Number two, the second row, prices really don't follow random walks. There are trends. Now, it doesn't mean that prices are predictable, but there are trends. And what you wind up with is a distinction between two different communities of investors who orient themselves very differently with respect to these trends. You have the momentum investors who basically trade or invest with the trend, and then the contrarian investors who try to trade against the trend. And a lot of what you see in the markets on a day-to-day basis is the result of this battle between the momentum and the contrarian investors. The other thing in an inefficient market is that you have a lot of people interested in non-symmetrical return distributions. Now, you see these distributions most clearly in the case of the options market. People who buy and sell options are typically interested in very asymmetrical patterns of return. But even in other markets, there are option-like forms of behavior. There are perhaps embedded options. And I think in particular you see this in the bond market. And the bond market has been at the center of the recent disaster. And the bond market, as we'll see later on, is a very heavy-duty short volatility business. A lot of options selling going on in that market. Now, in the deficient markets that we've had lately, and I'm thinking here primarily of the November episode when everybody thought the world was ending, and then they thought, well, maybe not yet, and then in March when, once again, the thought was that perhaps the world was ending. And I think there are three important things about those episodes. First of all, you didn't really have a battle anymore between fear and greed. Greed was out of the picture altogether. It was all fear, all the time, 24 hours a day. You also didn't have any sort of reasonable battle between momentum and contrarian investors. What you had was all momentum 24 hours a day. And a lot of this momentum was caused by the deleveraging phenomenon, essentially the margin call phenomenon, where the price goes down. That triggers a margin call, which forces further selling, which drives the price further down, which triggers yet more selling. So you wind up with these vicious spirals of selling, which are totally different from a totally random process. And number three, again, you have a lot of very asymmetrical return distributions kicking around. Having said all of that, there are still, I think, two fundamental ways in which markets remained very efficient throughout this period, even while George Soros and others were proclaiming the death of the idea of efficient and self-regulating markets. The efficient market view takes two forms of revenge. First of all, there are absolutely no free lunches, even in these episodes of maximum stress and irrationality. And number two, even in those episodes, basically nobody is able to predict with any confidence what is going to happen. So I think we have to be very humble about our ability to make predictions, very humble as we look for good investment opportunities, not to overblow them into the category of free lunches. So that's by way of markets in general. Lessons about portfolio construction. These are about liquidity, diversification, and risk. On the liquidity side, the most painful lesson was the lesson that was taught and learned by the U.S. university endowments, who I think, and I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, I think they fundamentally misunderstood the nature of long-term investing. Because what they thought was that if you're a long-term investor, then you don't need short-term liquidity resources. If you're investing for 20 years out, you don't need cash. That turns out to be exactly wrong, because the truth is that if you don't have liquid resources, you can't be an effective long-term investor. Because what happens to you, if you have any sort of spending needs, is that in a crisis, you become a forced seller of assets. And in my view, as soon as you become a forced seller, as soon as you are forced into a transaction that you know makes no economic sense, you have essentially lost the game. You're out. And a lot of universities learned that lesson very painfully. So I think as we move forward into the brave new world, people are going to have more respect for the power of cash, ordinary old liquidity. Diversification, This financial crisis was a massive flight to quality, and what we're told is that during this crisis, and during most crises, correlations move to one. This is half true, half false. The true part is that the correlations between or among all the risky assets moved toward one. The correlation between the risky assets and the safety assets actually approached minus one, because everybody was selling risk, buying quality, so risky assets are going down, safety assets are going up, correlation becomes negative. Now, just quickly on this, it's an interesting fact that in so-called normal financial environments or over very long time periods, there is a positive correlation between risky assets like equities and safety assets like government bonds. But this average long-term correlation is, I think, very misleading and can be very treacherous, because what it conceals is four very different types of investment environment. So what we have here is four boxes based on the performance of stocks and bonds. In the upper right, stocks and bonds are both going up. The lower left, they're both going down. In the upper left, stocks are up, bonds are down. And in the lower right, bonds are up and stocks are down. I call this, now the Goldilocks idea, this is in honor of Barton Biggs, who used to be at Morgan Stanley, and in his last years at Morgan Stanley had a lot of critical things to say about hedge funds, and then decided, okay, as long as hedge funds are really bad, I should start my own hedge fund, which is what he did, with many interesting tales to tell about how that worked out. Goldilocks, obviously, you have the three bowls of porridge, too hot, too cold, just right. So the idea here, and you can think of this historically, in the 1970s, you were in the lower left. High inflation created an environment that was much too hot, and that created a very bad environment for both stocks and bonds. In the 80s and the 90s, you moved into the upper right, a long period of disinflation, which created a very nice tailwind for both stocks and bonds. So in both of these periods, stocks and bonds were moving together. You move into the recent period, which is the lower right. Worries about deflation, recession, depression, all sorts of bad things. Basically, good for bonds, bad for stocks. And the puzzle, of course, is where do we go from here? What we know for sure is that we're not going to go to the upper right, because the upper right box is the post-inflation box, and we don't have a lot of inflation now, so the next period is not going to be a post-inflationary period. So we're either moving to the lower left or the upper left. The lower left is the box favored by the people who worry about massive amounts of new public debt to resuscitate the banking system, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going to create inflation, higher interest rates, devalued currencies, and all sorts of other bad things. So ultimately, we'll all be living in huts in the woods, eating Vegemite and leaves. In the upper left, and by the way, I actually like Vegemite. In moderation. In the upper left, we have a just right scenario where you have a little bit of inflation, but not fatal amounts of inflation. You have the modest amount of inflation that you would expect from a healthy environment of economic growth, growth in corporate profits. So in that sort of environment, stocks could actually do pretty well, even though government bonds might be under pretty severe pressure. So that's the question mark. Do we go upper left, lower left? My personal bet in the crunch. Actually, I don't have time to tell you what my personal bet is. So, okay, on to the next slide. I think one of the things that we learned in this recent period is that low-risk investment strategies can contain very high risks. And I go back to the idea of the asymmetrical distributions that you get in certain options selling strategies. The basic psychological framework, or the frame of mind of an options seller, is you're looking for the very high probability of some modest gain balanced against the low probability of something really bad happening. So it's very much a negatively skewed distribution, where you're worrying about the left tail event. And the problem with these types of strategies is that, in general, people don't worry enough about the left tail. And the left tail always rises up to kill them, which is why these strategies are often referred to as some version or other of picking up nickels in front of bulldozers. Just think of the various situations where we saw this playing out. AAA bonds, you buy a AAA bond, you have essentially no upside if you buy it at par. I mean, with luck, you get your interest and principal, but no real upside. But there is a downside of some unknown dimension, which turned out to be pretty big. Money market funds, that's supposed to be the most boring part of the investment business. So once the money market fund business becomes interesting and exciting, you know that there is something seriously wrong with the world. Out of the money, selling out of the money put options, this clearly is exactly what AIG did. I mean, a credit default swap is simply a put option on a corporate bond. AIG was selling lots and lots of deep out of the money puts, thought that they would never be exercised, thought that there was a low probability negative event, and obviously in the event that turned out to be exactly wrong. And even Bernie Madoff, dear old Bernie, is an example of this syndrome, because part of the secret of his success was that he presented himself to the market as a very conservative investor. I'm not going to get you 20 or 30%, I'm going to get you 8 or 9%. And once you present yourself as a conservative investor, there's this tendency in the business for the person on the other side of the table to sort of suspend their critical faculties. So what happens next? Now, there's a very gloomy view out there that the recent traumas are going to permanently diminish people's risk appetite. This could happen, but I think that something else may happen, which is that people may become more discriminating about risk, and in particular, more paranoid or more suspicious about the low-risk strategies, the negatively asymmetrical return distributions. So that, for example, if I come in and tell you I have this great equity strategy that's going to make you a 80 basis point premium annually over some global equity benchmark at very, very minimal risk, I think you're going to be suspicious of my pitch. You're going to be more suspicious of my pitch today than you would have been a year to a year and a half ago. You're going to say to yourself, okay, even if I'm only earning 80 basis points, I'm taking some risk. I better look very carefully to see exactly what the risk is that I'm taking. So interestingly, it's possible that the beneficiary of the trauma that we've been through is going to be, in fact, the family of slightly higher risk strategies, where you're more exposed to the right tail of the distribution rather than the left tail. So in other words, if I come in and say, look, I want to beat the benchmark by 8 percentage points, and I really don't give a damn what the exact construction is of my portfolio relative to the benchmark, I'm going to take more risk, more tracking error, et cetera, I think you might be more interested in that than in the 80 basis point incremental return strategy. So we'll see how this plays out, but I just... And by the way, the whole thing might be nonsense because recently all the markets have been on a tear, so we might be in the syndrome of, you know, you learn the lesson for 2 weeks and then you toss it away. But I do think there's some possibility of people getting more discriminating about risk. I'm going to skip some stuff here and talk about stocks. Actually, I'm going to go back one. The bond world. People used to talk about bonds as some sort of homogeneous universe. I think one of the big characteristics of the recent period is the totally disparate performance between corporate bonds and government bonds, most dramatically in the U.S. I mean, in the good old days, corporate bonds occupied a position sort of midway between treasuries and equities. Junk bonds, a little bit closer to equity. Investment-grade corporates, a little bit closer to treasuries. So you had a nice little spectrum of risk and return. In this recent period, this very massive flight away from risk, corporate bonds, both investment grade and high yield, basically got lumped together with equities. They got sold off as treasury bonds went up in value. Now, I think that this has created or helped to create an interesting situation with regard to stocks. Two important things about stocks. A, they've now had a negative return even over very long holding periods. I mean, the conventional wisdom is stocks go up and down on a yearly basis, but over the long haul, you get paid for taking equity risk. Well, we've had a long period where people haven't been paid. Now, It's interesting if you're in Australia, because if you invested in the local market over the last bunch of years, you did pretty well. But if you invested outside Australia, you shared in the global pain, and in some cases the pain was a little bit exaggerated because, for example, the Aussie dollar over the long period has shown some strength against the US dollar and some of the other currencies, so that strength actually added to your losses on the equity side. So the idea that stocks are somehow guaranteed to be a positive returning long-term investment, I think we can bury that idea. And I think the big lesson there is, and I think this sort of goes back to the philosophy business, where we think about, you know, very simple concepts like risk. The whole point about risk is that you don't know when you take the risk whether you're going to get paid for it. To the extent that you know that you're going to get paid, it's really not risk anymore. So we've learned that lesson very painfully. Interestingly, though, about stocks, throughout this crisis period, stocks have remained very liquid. There has been a tremendous amount of forced selling of stocks, but at the same time, stocks have found willing buyers. The credit market, by contrast, has been much more illiquid, much more frozen up. It's gotten better recently, but the credit market in general has been much less liquid than the equity market, which to me creates an interesting possibility, namely that stocks might, in some sense, be a better buy than credit. Now, I know that there are some very interesting opportunities in the credit market. There are even some interesting opportunities in some of the weirdo. They used to be called toxic assets on the balance sheets of the banks. Now we call them legacy assets. Legacy smells a little bit better. I know that there are some very interesting opportunities in that sector. I just urge you to be very cautious of the idea that because these opportunities are complicated and illiquid and weird, therefore they must offer a superior return. Again, it comes back to the point that when you take risk, you don't know whether you're going to get paid for taking it. Illiquidity risk is a form of risk. If you buy illiquid stuff, you may get paid for taking the illiquidity risk, you may not. What intrigues me about the equity universe at this stage of the game, and I'm talking here primarily about large cap, household name, global equities, is that in this period when people needed to sell assets to raise cash, virtually the only asset that they could sell was equities. So again, there has been a migration of equities from weaker hands, forced sellers, into stronger hands, willing buyers. That migration has not yet taken place with equities. We have no idea, I mean, just to take the most extreme example, we have no idea with regard to these legacy assets, I'm going to use the polite language, on the bank balance sheets, we have no idea whether the buyers and the sellers are going to be able to agree on a price. Because the buyers want to buy cheap, the sellers don't want to recognize losses from selling cheap. So we don't know how successful the market is going to be in finding a clearing price, whereas equities find a clearing price basically every minute of every day, which suggests to me less overhang, possibly an interesting opportunity. I want to offer you a couple thoughts about hedge funds, partly in honor of having spent 25 years in that business, so I feel I ought to say something about hedge funds, sort of justify the last quarter century. Clearly, hedge funds in general did not produce the mythical positive returns independent of market conditions. They did a lot better than the standard markets, but they lost money. So why did this happen? Two reasons. First of all, a lot of hedge funds weren't hedged. They were net long. If you were net long equity in 2008, or net long credit, or net long some other risky asset, chances are that you lost money. I think the more important point, more directly related to the sort of the essence of the hedge fund business, is that if you look at the hedges that hedge funds undertake, they have a very distinctive character. You have a long position and a short position, and the bet is that the long position will do better than the short position. It'll either go up more or down less. And when you look at specific examples, it often turns out that the long position is either more risky or less liquid than the short position, or both. And I'll just give you two examples. In the equity universe, very standard practice would be that you buy small to mid-cap stocks, under-researched companies, not so widely followed. You sell large-cap household names, maybe even you sell index futures. So that's a clear example of the long side being more risky or less liquid than the short side. In the fixed income area, a lot of fixed income hedge funds are essentially giant carry trades. And the name of the game in a carry trade is that you buy the higher yielding instrument, you sell short the lower yielding instrument, often a government bond. There's some interest rate differential, and then you leverage it up 20 times or 200 times, and then you start making serious money. Well, in the fixed income business, yield is often a proxy for risk. So what you're essentially doing in a carry trade is that you're owning the higher risk, selling the lower risk. So again, on a net basis, you are net long risk. You might be net long, you might not be net long interest rates or duration, but you are net long risk. So with that sort of posture, when you move into an environment where everybody is dumping risk in order to acquire safety assets, those trades are going to come under a lot of pressure. When I started in hedge funds, 1983, small number of funds, very small volume of assets. Nobody really knew what a hedge fund was. No one cared. And then over the course of the next 25 years, they became sort of the center of action in the investment business. And basically, the business had turned into a party. Parties are almost always unsustainable. So the hedge fund party is over, or it's in the process of ending. The hedge fund business, I would suggest to you, is still very much intact. For the people who are able to get through this recent period, they are going to be tougher, stronger. They're going to face less competition. Certainly, the bank trading desks, which were in the old days a major source of competition for trading ideas for hedge funds, are either out of that business or their profile is drastically dialed down. So for the people who are still in the business, the real professionals, the opportunity set is in fact better than before. I had some nasty things to say about private equity, but I'm not going to do that. The final thoughts, I think it's all pretty straightforward. I mean, this has been an extraordinary period in which we have seen in very dramatic form very serious forms of inefficiency. Tremendous amounts of fear, tremendous amounts of forced selling, tremendous amounts of non-random behavior, the whole vicious cycle phenomenon. These are all very, very important attributes of what we're seeing lately. But two truths still stand out. A, the extraordinary opportunities that are being created are opportunities. They are not free lunches. You know, they aren't $100 notes sitting on the sidewalk waiting to be picked up. And number two, the basic unpredictability of what's going to happen is still with us. So, I mean, you can't approach your business without having a view, some view about what the future is going to look like. But I think we just need to be very humble as we hold those views and adapt them to changing circumstances. So, thank you very much.